There's no doubt about it. The pandemic has changed the course of the future. Now, let's go shopping. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Oakland, I'm Molly Wood, in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Monday, March 22nd. Thanks for joining us today. Ken confirmed the facts of this next story. We are tired of the pandemic and ready to shop. The technical term for this, of course, is consumer sentiment, which determines how much we spend, which makes up about two-thirds of this economy, and which is kind of key to our pandemic recovery. Well, the University of Michigan's Consumer Confidence Survey shot up more than 8% in March to its highest level in a year. That's still 7% below what it was before the pandemic, but the government rescue package combined with the $1,400 check or checks landing in many people's accounts, well, it's a pick-me-up. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman gets us going.
It's been a week and a half since President Biden signed the American Rescue Plan. Payments started going out within days, and that's been a big shot in the arm for consumers, says John Lear at Morning Consult, which polls Americans every day.
Consumer confidence is really on a tear. They are growing more confident at a faster rate than they have following the prior two stimulus packages.
Lear says this time around the checks are bigger and they're going out faster. Plus, the money's targeted to low and middle income households who are most likely to have lost work and be strapped for cash. Now, rising confidence is likely to spark more consumer spending. But Lisa Rowan at Forbes Advisor says it's not clear how much or how fast.
What we're seeing now is this really cautious optimism where people say, okay, we can see signs that things are going to be getting better, but we're not quite ready to jump in, you know, head first.
Forbes Advisor's latest survey finds roughly half of Americans don't believe it's a good idea to reopen businesses 100% before coronavirus is fully contained. And Morning Consult finds well over half of Americans still don't feel comfortable traveling or going to a restaurant, shopping mall, or sporting event. John Lear says more vaccination and continued coronavirus vigilance are crucial.
We're sort of at this critical junction right now where we need to keep cases down for the next 3 months, let's say, so that we're able to unleash the full extent of our pent-up demand later in the summer.
He says the money's there, from the latest relief checks and surging savings. Folks just aren't feeling quite confident enough to spend it up yet. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
In addition to shopping, you may also be considering going to the movies. It's been about a year since COVID-19 shut down movie theaters across the country. Now some of those theaters are reopening. But if you're all excited for extra butter, overpriced candy, and a soda in a gallon jug-sized cup, not so fast. Masks will be required, making snacking tricky, and some theaters have even banned snacks entirely. That is a problem because a huge chunk of their profits comes from the concession stand. Marketplace's Jasmine Garst reports.
Delicious things to eat.
The popcorn can't be beat.
That 1957 movie trailer for snacks says it all. Going to the movies has always been partly about eating. Popcorn, Juicy Fruits, Junior Mints. Snacks are about 40% of a movie theater's revenue, says NYU professor Charles Schrager, who focuses on the business of entertainment.
Theaters make money by your buying a ticket, and then they have to give a lot of that money, usually about 50% of it, back to the studios. So it's a relatively low margin business. They make this huge profit margin on selling you popcorn.
San Francisco has outright banned food and drinks in theaters. But will people even want to eat at the movies? Former moviegoer Jose Hernandez in Los Angeles says it's a no for him.
Having to, you know, like pull your mask down to, you know, eat your popcorn and soda isn't, you know, it's not the same. It's just not time yet.
The days of sitting in the dark, shoving nachos into your mouth while crying to Ryan Gosling are nowhere near back. John Vanko is the senior vice president of the IFC Center, a movie theater in New York. They are only allowed to fill a quarter of their seats and have decided no snacks or drinks.
It makes things a little more challenging to not be selling concessions. 25% seating capacity is a real challenge, too. But honestly, it's a lot better than 0% capacity, which is what we were stuck at for 51 weeks.
Vanko says they see this as a phase. I'm Jasmine Garst for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, consumer confidence is market confidence, today at least. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Some good vaccine news today. In preliminary results from U.S. clinical trials, the Oxford-AstraZeneca COVID-19 vaccine is 79% effective overall and 100% effective at preventing severe disease. But it's still not actually approved for use here, and we have a lot of it. Last week, the Biden administration said it'll send about 4 million doses of that AstraZeneca vaccine to Canada and Mexico, but it's still holding on to several million more, even though the vaccine has been approved in a number of countries that desperately need it. As Marketplace's Samantha Fields reports, not sharing has consequences.
The U.S. already has contracts to buy more than enough doses of COVID vaccine for everyone in the country. And sometime this summer, supply will exceed demand, says Ezekiel Emanuel, who advised President Biden during the transition.
And we should be pretty aggressive about sending the vaccine overseas to help other countries that are in need.
China, which has largely gotten COVID under control, is sending more than half of its doses to other countries. And Emmanuel says it's in the interest of the U.S. to start doing a little vaccine diplomacy, too.
It would make a big soft power difference in terms of foreign affairs to these countries. And I think that's very important from an ethical standpoint, very important from an international diplomatic standpoint.
Because most countries don't have the capacity to produce the vaccine on their own, it's also the only way to get the pandemic under control, says Glenn Cohen, a bioethicist at Harvard.
In a world where COVID is running rampant across the world, but not in the United States, unless we're going to be a fortress nation that's not going to let anybody travel here ever, right? You're going to have variants emerge elsewhere in such a way that they pose a danger to the United States.
Both health-wise and economically. If people in other countries around the world aren't vaccinated for another couple of years, Cohen says,
those are people who can't travel to our shores. They're people who will not be able to consume our goods. There are people who will be in situations of political instability and suffering, and there's going to be major economic loss.
And Cohen says the U.S. is now in a position to do something about that, both by sharing what it has and by pushing drug companies to ramp up production even more. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
So you heard Samantha Fields there explaining how vaccine distribution is shaping the global economy. In fact, all the elements of this pandemic have consequences for the future. Remote learning, remote work, our dependence on big tech, how governments have responded. And that all leads me to Amy Webb, futurist and founder of the Future Today Institute. I spoke to Amy at the outset of the pandemic and I asked her what's going to change because of this crisis. And I called her up again to get her take on what's happened and where we're headed.
Last year at this time when we talked, the virus felt like it was emerging. The problem is that we had like a 4-month lead time.
Yep.
And nobody seemed to be prepared, even though we were essentially watching a slow motion explosion happening. And then in the aftermath of that, we saw, you know, I don't know, there's no other way to phrase this. I mean, we saw a government leadership that just didn't have the chops.
Yeah.
And I think that created this vacuum for Google and Apple to step in and try to build contact tracing systems. And a year later, everyday people stepping up to build coronavirus vaccine information websites because it's been so challenging and there was no direction whatsoever. And in the interim, we've got companies making decisions about whether or not to allow people to do their business or to say what they want to say. I think there's been a really profound shift that everyday people will start to recognize that hasn't been apparent yet, because we've been dealing with the crisis from day to day.
You know, it's clear that in some ways this has been a big disruption, but it's kind of just the beginning, right? We've got really disruptive technologies coming. Some of them might be great in terms of medical advances. Some of them, you know, will be AI driven, and that could kind of go either way. Are we more or less prepared as a society, do you think?
I would hope that as the fever breaks from this series of catastrophic events, that we emerge with more self-awareness. And part of that self-awareness is that things can change at any time, and we have to be flexible in our thinking about the future. That's my hope.
And yet you don't sound that confident.
Well, listen,
we're still in it. We should acknowledge, right?
We're still in it. That's right. We are still in it. We're still grappling with all the change. Mm. My bigger concern, however, is that the fundamental problems aren't going away. And the fundamental problems are that there's too great a separation between government and tech and business. Investors are very much focused on the D in R&D and not so much the R. So they don't make room for longer term planning and, you know, building risk models and stuff. That they're not interested in that. They want fast returns. We should emerge from this with a different perspective, mm-hmm. but we have to then be willing to act differently. And that's, I'm not seeing that yet.
Has there been a new path over the last year, something that you would not have anticipated, something that was opened up that either raises a lot of questions or is, you know, a whole new direction?
You know, I guess I did not see COVID-19 accelerating the adoption of national digital ID programs. Increasingly, you know, we're all going to be asked for these data points that will very likely be housed at a national level. You know, whether that's a COVID vaccine passport of some kind or a record of who you've interacted with and where you've been. And I think that's pretty concerning.
I remember you said, I mean, that's what you told us, as you said, I think this will lead to the end of privacy.
And it has. If you take nothing away from this conversation, just, you know that privacy is dead. Now, that sounds apocalyptic and horrible. And it kind of is. But,
I watch a lot of comic book movies, so resurrection is possible, I hope.
Well, so yeah, I mean, here's the thing. There's no going back. There is no going back. Privacy is dead. So let's acknowledge that. Let's acknowledge it and figure out a better way to move forward. The problem is that we are not publicly acknowledging it. Mm-hmm. We are just pressing on and hoping nothing goes wrong.
Amy Webb is a futurist and founder of the Future Today Institute. Thanks so much for talking with me.
Thank you.
Coming up.
The problem is that they're just worth so much.
They're called precious metals for a reason, right? But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average added 103.3% to finish at 32,731. The NASDAQ picked up 162 points, 0.2% to end at 13,377. And the S&P 500 found 27.7% to land up at 3940. Jasmine Garst crunched those movie theater finances, so let's butter up the popcorn and head to the cinema. AMC fell more than 10%. Cineplex lost 1.7%. Sales of existing homes, the homes that have been previously occupied, dropped in February by 6.6% from the month before. That's in part because there just aren't a lot of those homes for sale. As of the end of February, housing inventory remained at a record low. As a result, prices have been rising. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.69%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know.
Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Marketplace. I'm Molly Wood. When education in this country went remote, a lot of inequalities and underpreparedness were exposed. But, no pun intended, there are lessons to be learned, too. The Nonprofit Technology Alliance, which focuses on Washington State, released a report recently called Learning from Calamity. It looks at the impact of remote learning, what aspects might stick around, and how we can prepare for the next big disruption. Laura Ruderman is the CEO of Technology Alliance. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
What are the elements of online learning, do you think, that could stick around, that could improve the education system?
Well, I think it's very clear that elements will stick around. We have several school districts that are looking at starting online-only programs because there are students who are thriving in this environment. There are BIPOC students who are happy not to have to deal with the racism that goes on in schools. There are kids with social anxiety. So we've heard that there are school districts who are in Washington who are looking at having some form of remote learning persist for those who want it. But in order to do that, you need sufficient funding and support and training.
Let's talk about sort of lessons learned. You've also said we have to remember that teaching in person and teaching remotely are fundamentally different things, but that we should instruct teachers in how to do both, right?
Yes. I think anybody who's ever participated in a meeting in person versus run a meeting remotely understands that it is not a one-to-one translation. Your ability to focus on a live teacher standing in front of you, we can do that for longer than we can stare at a screen. So there's just all of these different things that go into teaching remotely versus teaching in person that are just qualitatively different.
Well, and you know, we talk a lot about the lack of devices and the lack of internet access for students and families, but that's true for teachers too. They're not necessarily experts or well-equipped themselves.
Absolutely. And that's one of the things that we stress over and over in this report. Our teachers need that the same access to high-quality internet and high-quality devices and the same kind of support for the remote learning. So there are a lot of different aspects that are going to have to change in order for this to be successful, right? We looked at connectivity, IT support, but we also looked at non-technical things like family engagement coordinators. It's really a full spectrum of issues that we need to start working on now because they will take time to plan and implement.
What do you think is, I mean, if you could just choose one or two, the kind of most significant places to put energy and resource, is it internet? Is it devices? Is it training?
You know, the problem is that's a little bit like asking a person who's doing a jigsaw puzzle if they mm-hmm. should do the frame or the interior.
Right.
The puzzle isn't going to be complete without all of the different pieces. Your students have great internet and terrific devices. And if you forget about your teachers, you have a problem, right? They really are all interlocking pieces. And that's really important because the mess that this pivot was this time can be chalked up to a failure of imagination. But the next time, it will be seen as a failure of leadership if it's this much of a mess again.
Laura Ruderman is CEO of the Nonprofit Technology Alliance. Thanks so much for talking with me.
Well, thank you. This has been a real pleasure.
This interview was part of a series on my show, Marketplace Tech. We did a week on the effects of the pandemic over the last year. You can have a listen every weekday or on your smart speaker. Lots of people lately are learning what a catalytic converter is. Unfortunately, that's probably because theirs was stolen. The devices on the bottom of cars clean up exhaust emissions. They also contain trace amounts of precious metals, including one called rhodium, which as of today was selling for about $28,000 an ounce. Gold, by comparison, trades for less than $2,000 an ounce. And that is all the ingredients you need for a nationwide crime wave. Dan Crocker of Minnesota Public Radio has more.
Jean Bentley is a retired nurse who lives in St. Paul. Back in January, she picked up a shift at a nearby clinic that was short-staffed that day.
And when I went out to start my vehicle at a little after 5, it was just that, like you don't have a muffler.
She knew immediately what that noise meant. Bentley had friends and neighbors who also had catalytic converters sawed off from their cars. She had insurance to get it fixed, but her deductible was $1,000.
So I just had to bite it, and you got to get it fixed. But it's a shame, you know, when you're trying to work extra shifts and help out, and then you're paying extra money instead of saving.
Thieves have been stealing more and more catalytic converters over the past year. According to the National Insurance Crime Bureau, in 2019, on average, 282 thefts were reported each month. Last year, that number jumped to 1,200 per month, and it's happening everywhere, from St. Paul to L.A. to Dallas.
Well, it's about the precious metals that are used in the catalytic converter.
Michael Motes is a professor of metallurgical engineering at the Missouri University of Science and Technology in the small town of Rolla, about 100 miles outside St. Louis.
And it is everywhere. Actually, our little church here in our town, the catalytic converters were stolen off of our church vans.
When your car burns gas, the exhaust has contaminants in it, like nitrogen oxide, which is the stuff that causes acid rain. Catalytic converters break down those compounds before they're released into the air.
And we need that to happen really fast, because you can imagine that the gases leave the engine very fast and come out the exhaust pipe. So we need to have highly active metals to promote those chemical reactions.
Metals like platinum, palladium, and rhodium. Paul Danhauer, an engineering professor at the University of Minnesota, says one catalytic converter only contains a few grams of these metals in very thin layers.
The problem is that they're just worth so much. You know, we think of platinum as more valuable than gold, but rhodium is 10 times more valuable than platinum. So in the end, even if just a small amount of metal in this catalytic converter, it's just worth so much per ounce.
And thieves can slither under cars and saw them off in just a couple minutes. Steve Linders with the St. Paul Police Department says one catalytic converter can fetch up to $300 at a scrapyard.
We'd frequently see reports where an officer would pull over a vehicle for a traffic violation, and one thing would lead to another, and they'd find a trunk full of catalytic converters and a Sozzle and jacks and things like that.
Lawmakers in 18 states, including Minnesota, have proposed legislation to restrict the sale of catalytic converters because right now, Linders says,
unless we catch them in the act, there's not a lot we can do.
Many car owners are taking matters into their own hands and spending $200 to $300 to install specialized locks designed to deter thieves. That's not cheap, but it's a lot less than the couple $1,000 it can cost for a replacement. I'm Dan Crocker for Marketplace.
This final note on your way out today is just a perfect example of a company trying to thread the PR needle. Krispy Kreme is showing its support for the COVID-19 vaccine effort. Employees get paid time off to go get shots, and people with a valid COVID vaccine card can now get a free donut every single day. The campaign is called Be Sweet to the Community. Message received. Get the vaccine. It helps everyone, right? Although Krispy Kreme's website also says that, hey, we understand this is a personal choice and maybe you don't want to get the vaccine. And if that's the case, you can still get a free donut until the end of May, just only on Mondays. Here's your moment of economic context before we go. You are not imagining it. You're burned out. Research from four countries, including the U.S., finds that the average remote employee is working more than 2 hours more every day than they were when they were in the office. 11 hours a day in the U.S. So yeah, cancel that meeting. You earned it. Our daily production team includes Andy Corbin, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Minju Park. I'm Molly Wood, in for Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.